2 more Palestinian children die of malnutrition as a World Food Program says over 500,000 people face catastrophic hunger and starvation in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq carries out another anti-Israeli operation, hitting the regime's main international airport with a drone. And the Yemeni army says it's attacked an American ship in the Red Sea with naval missiles in support of Palestinian people in Gaza. And now, over 5 months into the genocide in Gaza, the Israeli regime continues killing more civilians in fresh airstrikes. Nearly 70 Palestinians are killed and over 100 injured in the past 24 hours alone. Latest attacks hit residential buildings in Rafah in Gaza City, killing at least 19 Palestinians and injuring dozens. There's also been a surge in Israeli attacks on the city of Khan Yunis to the south, where an ongoing systematic and controlled demolition of residential homes is underway. Meanwhile, the UN Secretary General has called for a truce in Gaza as the holy month of Ramadan begins.
My strongest appeal today is to honor the spirit of Ramadan by silencing the guns and removing all obstacles to ensure the delivery of life-saving aid at the speed and massive scale required.
Guterres warned international humanitarian law lies in tatters. He added any Israeli assault on Rafah could plummet the people of Gaza into an even deeper circle of hell. Overall death toll from an Israeli onslaught has risen to over 31,100, most of them women and children, and more than 72,000 others have been injured. The World Food Program has warned of what it called worst food crisis in recent history of the besieged Gaza Strip. It says more than 500,000 people are facing catastrophic hunger and starvation there. The WFP says the risk of famine in Gaza increases by the day, adding its entire population is now in desperate need of food assistance. Severe food and water shortages have already taken a heavy toll on the Palestinians of Gaza. Two Palestinian babies died on Monday due to malnutrition and lack of medical supplies, bringing the tally of such fatalities to 27 since Israeli onslaught began in early October. This while people throughout the blockaded territory are observing the fasting month of Ramadan. The Gaza Health Ministry says more than 2,000 health staff in northern Gaza have not found anything to break their fast with on the first day of Ramadan. Now, Palestinians in Gaza are welcoming the holy month of Ramadan amid huge loss of life and devastation caused by a U.S.-Israeli campaign of genocide. Mutu Abu Musaba joined us earlier with an update from the central city of Deir al-Balah.
This is not the first time Palestinian people are spending Ramadan under Israeli aggression. In 2014, the Israeli regime also waged a destructive war on Gaza during the holy month. However, the current genocidal war is unprecedented in terms of its colossal casualties. Many Palestinians have become orphans and widows and lost their children. The memory of their loved ones will stay with them in Ramadan.
The life here is so difficult. The holy month of Ramadan is around the corner and we are still displaced from our homes and our families are torn apart. We have nothing to eat for iftar. I'm originally from Gaza. I've lost 37 members of my family. They were so close to my heart. Every time I remember them, my gut is wrenched and I become so sad and furious.
With markets destroyed and goods scarce, Gazans don't know where their iftar meals will come from, which means more suffering and agony. The vast majority of the people live in small tents amid the starvation that has already claimed the lives of several Palestinian children.
The situation in Gaza is very difficult. There is no food. The people are struggling to find anything to eat with flour scarce. Here in the south, they queue in long lines for food. Even those who attempt to get anything from the aid trucks are putting their lives at risk as Israeli soldiers open fire on them. I don't know what we're going to do in Ramadan.
Palestinians' catastrophe doesn't stop with the loss of their relatives. It is deepened by the full-scale destruction that has become palpable in every corner of Gaza, including mosques, which means they won't be able to say their prayers and worships as usual. Even if their mosques hadn't been destroyed, it would still be impossible for them to perform their prayers under the incessant Israeli bombardments.
The humanitarian conditions are completely disastrous. The people were displaced from several parts of Gaza, including the northern and central areas of the Strip. It is literally catastrophic. There is no source of income or food, and the people are completely relying on the small amounts of donation provided by a limited numbers of charity institutions. In addition to that, mosques have been completely destroyed by Israeli warplanes, and we will never be able to pray in them.
While some aid has been trickling into Gaza, it's minuscule compared to the needs of the Palestinians. With Ramadan arriving, more assistance cannot come soon enough for them.
As the whole Muslim nation welcomes Ramadan, Palestinians are wondering why they have been abandoned by many Muslim leaders to face the Israeli campaign of death and starvation. To Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
The Iranian president says the holy month of Ramadan presents an opportunity to fight hegemonic powers, particularly the Israeli regime. Ibrahim Raisi said a cherished month can reinforce ties among Muslims and strengthen and promote Islam. He expressed confidence the Palestine will be liberated as Palestinians continue battles against Israel and Muslims continue to keep up their earnest support for them. Raisi made the remarks in a congratulatory message on the occasion of the advent of the fasting month. In a social media post, Iran's foreign minister also said Muslim countries can come closer in Ramadan and take the initiative to stop U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Hossein Amri Abdullahian stressed the Palestinian people and resistance will be the ultimate victors on the battlefield. People across the Palestinian territories began Ramadan on Monday amid malnutrition and dehydration in Gaza. The UN estimates about a quarter of the Gaza population risks starvation, and aid is barely scratching the surface of their daily needs. We'll now take you to Rafah, where some Palestinians describe their miseries and their hopes for a lasting ceasefire.
First day of Ramadan is very tough. We don't know what we are going to cook, what we are going to have for iftar. There is no gas. We get out of the tent in the cold to light fire, and it's really cold. How are we going to cook? Also, the prices are unimaginable. Prices of the tomato and the potato. The prices are high. We can't get meat or chicken. Everything is very expensive. In this situation, we don't want aid. What we want is a ceasefire.
We're happy that we're in Ramadan, but we're not happy that we've been displaced from one place to another. We don't want to stay in a tent. We want to settle in our homes and for things to return to normalcy, and may God bring peace and fix the situation. We don't want food or drink. We want to return to our homes, check on them, and stay there in happiness. We are living and sleeping here in fear.
I'm 71 years old and I have never experienced a Ramadan with this feeling. It's an awful feeling. At times like this during Ramadan, I used to prepare the dining table to eat at sunset. But today there is no food and I don't have money to get food for iftar at sunset.
Israeli forces have murdered two more Palestinians as they carry out fresh raids on occupied West Bank city of Tulkarm. Mohammed Jafar and Mustafa Jaber were shot dead near the town of Atil, north of Tulkarm. That happened after an undercover Israeli Special Forces troop opened fire at him from a civilian car. Regime forces also killed 25-year-old Tawfiq Ayed Fawaz Hussein, north of Tulkarm by live fire. Tensions are running high throughout occupied territories, where Israeli troops are carrying out deadly raids on an almost daily basis. The regime forces raided several areas Monday, the first day of the holy month of Ramadan. Areas include the city of Qalqilya, Nur Sham's refugee camp near Tulkarm, and a village west of Ramallah. They abducted a number of Palestinians following clashes with resistance fighters. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it's carried out a retaliatory attack on Ben Gurion Airport deep inside Israeli-occupied territories. Umbrella resistance group said it targeted the strategic international airport with a drone. It vowed to continue these operations against what it called enemy strongholds in support of the people in Gaza and in response to Israeli genocide against Palestinians. Since last October, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israeli positions. It's also attacked U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for its complicity in the genocide in Gaza. And the Yemeni army has carried out yet another operation against American vessels in solidarity with Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. Army spokesperson Yahya Sadi said Yemeni forces targeted a U.S. vessel Pinocchio in the Red Sea with a number of appropriate naval missiles. Sadi added the hit was accurate. Spokesperson said army will continue to prevent navigation of Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea until the regime stops its aggression on Gaza and lifts the siege on the coastal territory. He also warned such operations will be escalated during the holy month of Ramadan. The Yemeni armies carried out numerous attacks in the Red Sea, targeting U.S. and British vessels as well in recent months. It says attacks are in response to two countries' support for Israel and its genocidal campaign against Gazans. And tensions continue soaring throughout the southern Lebanese border amid Israel's onslaught on Gaza. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says it's carried out a series of retaliatory operations against Israeli targets north of occupied territories. We were earlier joined for an update by our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh.
Well, we do know that Hezbollah has launched several operations, but the most significant one is the one that you mentioned, of course, against the barracks of Keilah, and that is an area which is considered very strategic for the Israelis. Also, this is, of course, very qualitative, especially with the fact that Hezbollah decided to use four drones, kamikaze-style drones, and this means that this target is very important. They say that they hit their target very precisely, and that is what they call the command center, which they targeted is the command center for the air defense system and the rocket defense areas of the Israelis. We have been hearing from the Israelis lately that Hezbollah has focused on basically targeting the defense systems of the Israelis. And this, although has not stopped the Israelis' activities when it comes to their air activities and their drones flying over Lebanese skies, however, it will be on the long run very detrimental for the Israeli defenses in any type of confrontation that they will have to face with Hezbollah. They are basically getting weakened. The Hezbollah also launched with their mortars and their guided missiles and perhaps even anti-tank missiles, the Jala al-Alam post, which is also one of the posts that is usually targeted. It's on the eastern side on the western side of the border. They also launched another attack against Israeli soldiers in Talat al-Tayhat.
The National Iranian Oil Company signed a contract worth $20 billion to boost gas pressure at the giant South Pars field in the Persian Gulf. Under the strategic project, 90 trillion cubic feet of gas will be available for use. Fatima Masumi has more.
The Iranian National Oil and Gas Company says that this is the most strategic project in the history of Iran's oil and gas industry and its long-sought empowerment of domestic entities. Under this project, 90 trillion cubic feet of gas and 2 billion barrels of gas condensates will be available for use. Top Iranian companies Petropars, Oil Industries Engineering and Construction, Khatam al-Anbiya Construction Headquarters, Mapna Group, and a consulting company are the contractors of the mega project.
In the subject matter of the development and increase of capacities of the gas and oil refineries, we witnessed the second phase of Abadan refinery with the capacity of 210,000 barrels, which helped the production and supply of gas in the country. In the 14th phase of the South Pars refineries, 50 million cubic feet of gas is produced per day, which again adds to the capacity of gas production in the country.
The massive project has created an opportunity to kickstart economic prosperity and employment in the face of unilateral Western sanctions. This has also allowed Iranian producers and companies to engage greatly in the economic growth and industrial development of the country and neutralize the sanctions.
Today, all Iranian people should witness the fact that the surrounding nations trust the Iranian National Oil Company and the relative competent companies and contractors and do rely on them, because they know well that the South Pass was built by Iranian companies, and the day that they thought that it was impossible to do so without the help and presence of foreigners, that exact day was the day that South Pass became what it is today.
While sanctions have forced the governing bodies to change their attitude towards domestic companies and entrust them with tasks, it should be noted that Iranian producers are not perennial supporters of sanctions. Rather, they would like to interact and acquire world-class technologies from foreign companies to empower themselves.
With contracts for developing oil and gas fields signed and projects for boosting pressure in South Pars gas field being started, Iran is experiencing yet another success in the mega gas project to exploit the immense gas field. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
To understand the unsavory alliance that has held the United States and the Zionist regime together is to understand that they are cut from the same cloth. Both regimes share a ruthless, exploitative settler colonial ideology and psychology that has set them on parallel social, political, and economic paths. They have existed by exploitation and churning the cauldron of division and conflict among countries in the region. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Palestine Chronicle wrote, after half a century of steadfast support, it has become virtually impossible for Washington to imagine a regional reality that does not have the fabricated regime of Israel at its core. The Israeli regime war on Gaza has been oiled by the military, financial, and diplomatic benefaction of the United States regime. While President Joe Biden makes passive public appeals for the Israeli regime to show restraint, behind closed doors, he reaffirms America's continued support. The administration's recent indulgence of the Zionist regime was visible during a March 4, 2024 meeting in the White House between the Zionist regime's minister Benny Gantz and Vice President Kamala Harris. At that meeting, the vice president stated the administration's displeasure with the dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza, but in the same breath, told Gantz that the United States wanted to continue supporting Israel, but that Tel Aviv needed to do its part, stating, "Help us help you." The infamous hike that was seen around the world has come to haunt even a committed Zionist like Biden. In order to retrieve a modicum of domestic and international credibility, after the Zionist regime's massacre of more than 100,000 Palestinians, the administration has put on its humanitarian face. Salvage efforts that have been for Palestinians are obviously too timid and too late. The language, action, and inaction that has emanated from the Biden White House indicate that either the Zionist regime is calling the shots in Washington, or the administration is on board with the Zionist regime's genocidal plan to empty Gaza and the West Bank of Palestinians. It also seems evident that Biden, who has said on a number of occasions, "I am a Zionist," has been beguiled by the myths and fantasies that the Jewish regime has created. In the face of domestic and global condemnation, the U.S. administration has embraced the right-wing regime in Tel Aviv. It has continued to block United Nations resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire. Recently, on February 29th, the U.S. regime alone, among the 15 members of the U.N. Security Council, opposed a statement expressing deep concern over the Zionist regime's military killing of Palestinians who had gathered near trucks carrying food to Gaza City. At least 112 were martyred and another 760 injured in what is now called the Flower Massacre. In a symbolic display of concern following the massacre, the U.S. regime began airdropping humanitarian aid into Gaza while simultaneously supplying the fabricated regime of Israel with bombs to drop on Gaza. During the U.S. administration's first photo op on March 2nd, the U.S. and Jordanian air forces dropped 38,000 meals to some 1.5 million Palestinians. Water and medical supplies were not included. Biden refused to blame the child killer regime of Israel for blocking aid into Gaza, but said he would insist that Israel open additional routes and allow more aid trucks to enter. In its eagerness to indulge the Zionist regime, the U.S. administration has been willing to break U.S. laws. The Biden administration has used emergency powers to bypass arms sales reviews and congressional oversight to expedite its arms transfers to Israel. It is currently violating the Foreign Assistance Act 1961, Arms Export Control Act 1976, War Crimes Act 1996, Genocide Convention Implementation Act 1987-88, and the Lehi Laws 1997-98. The White House is awash in rhetoric. It has, however, refused to put any real limits on the Zionist regime's violence, choosing instead to stoke the Israeli war machine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, for example, during discussions in February 2024 with the Zionist regime's leaders in Tel Aviv, sheepishly stated, "It will be up to Israelis to decide what they want to do, when they want to do it, how they want to do it. No one's going to make those decisions for them." The U.S. administration's actions, even when confronted with the Zionist regime's systematic violence against the Palestinians, clearly indicate that the U.S. financial and military hegemonic interests outweigh what little is left of its humanity. Like his predecessors, Biden has shown no genuine concern for the Palestinians, for the region and its people. He has, however, been dedicated to integrating the Zionist regime into the Arab West Asia region. To realize the Biden's integration policy, he has continued to expand on former President Donald Trump's objective of strengthening military cooperation and economic ties among family-ruled Arab dictators and the Zionist regime. He has pressed ahead with the Trump-era Abraham Accords, a set of Arab-Israeli normalization agreements initiated in September 2020 and signed by the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan. When the accords were initiated, the Trump administration and its Arab partners believed that Palestinians could be ignored, that they were irrelevant, and that they would simply accept their slow death. Biden has amplified that disregard. The U.S. administration is under the impression that deepening economic and military ties with Arab despots will lead to regional stability, which ultimately translates into U.S.-Israeli hegemony. It is worth noting that the region remains volatile, even though Riyadh and Tel Aviv have cooperated covertly for years, as have Bahrain, the UAE, Oman, Qatar, and Egypt. After close to 5 months of the Zionist regime's atrocities, Biden continues to push for what Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi once called the deal of the century, a normalization pact between Saudi Arabia and the Zionist regime. The United States regime sees Saudi Arabia as the integration linchpin. If Riyadh, the largest and wealthiest Persian Gulf country, allies with the Zionist regime, the White House believes that others will fall in line.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone. On the threshold of the blessed month of Ramadan, here is food for thought from Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Reza, peace be upon him, the 8th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. God Almighty writes a reward for 2 successive months of fasting for those who fast on the last 3 days of the month of Sha'ban, continuing with their fasting through Ramadan.
Thank you. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Fasting Will Make You Righteous. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service, dear friends. This is A to Z. So we are talking about the holy month of Ramadan and Islamic lifestyle. So what we want to talk about on the program is this idea that fasting will make you righteous. Now, if we read the Holy Quran, inshallah, before the holy month of Ramadan and during the holy month of Ramadan and inshallah after the holy month of Ramadan, we will find that there are many beautiful ways in which the Holy Quran talks about fasting. And so if we look at chapter number 2, which is Surah Al-Baqarah, and verse number 183, we find that Allah the Almighty talks about fasting, and He describes fasting in a very beautiful way. You know, sometimes one of the issues that we have is that we don't really understand the essence of the holy month of Ramadan. And likewise, we don't really understand the essence of fasting. Now, perhaps this has many different reasons, you know, for example, the environment in which we grew up in, or what we have been taught in that environment. You know, are they conducive to Islamic teachings? Are they conducive to the various teachings of other divinely sent religions or not, right? So if we live in a purely materialistic society, then of course we'll find that, you know, we might not be so in tuned and kind of, you know, appreciate the essence of fasting. But if we live in a society or if we live in a place where we have access to adequate knowledge about Islamic practices, we will realize, you know, the essence of fasting and we'll be able to appreciate it. So this is what we're talking about, is the essence of fasting and how it will make us righteous.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about the essence of fasting. And of course, we are talking about this verse from the Holy Quran, chapter number 2, verse number 183. So in this chapter, of course, fasting has been, it is said that fasting has been prescribed for the people as it was prescribed for people before us, so that we may become righteous, so that we may be able to guard against evil, so that we may attain taqwa, this God awareness, this God consciousness, this piety. So when we start to think along these lines, of course, which they are the lines which the Holy Quran has given us, then we really, you know, begin to understand a little bit about the essence and this, you know, inner reality of fasting. So what we have been told now in the Holy Quran, specifically in this verse, is that fasting was not just prescribed for us in the modern day, but it was also prescribed for the people before us. And that's what's interesting, is that in many of the other, you know, quote-unquote, Abrahamic religions, Christianity and Judaism, you will find that there is an emphasis upon fasting. And well, we'll talk about that on another program, but what is the ultimate goal of fasting, or what is the ultimate net yield of fasting? Well, the result of fasting is that you become righteous, you become noble, you become honorable, you attain this taqwa. Taqwa, of course, you know, commonly translated as piety, or this awareness of the existence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so inshallah, this is one of the things that we should be working towards in the holy month of Ramadan, and that is to attain that piety, that consciousness of Allah, that taqwa, inshallah, via our fasting.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will carefully monitor the disagreements within Netanyahu's administration and the repercussions that Benny Gantz's visit to the United States left behind, which were exacerbated by the resignations of officers in the Information Department and the Occupation Army. In addition, we will go over the failure of the truce negotiations and the captives exchange deal in light of the demands for Netanyahu's resignation and going to early elections. This is while the opinion polls have also favored Gantz over Netanyahu. Regarding these topics, I welcome the specialist in Israeli affairs, Mr. Ali Haider, with a warm welcome. So let's start from the battlefield, where the fighting in Khan Yunus has not ended yet. Hamas has not been eliminated, nor has the tunnels been destroyed, and the occupation army is still unable to achieve those two goals. Mr. Ali Haider, despite the destruction and massacres, there is an explicit admission that Khan Yunus and other areas of Gaza are still difficult for the occupation army. How will this be reflected on the reality of the occupation?
In the name of God, in fact, we're facing a field scene that constitutes a kind of impasse for the Israeli occupation. It cannot continue in the current situation as it is, in light of the continuation of operations every day in which Israelis are killed and wounded, and this constitutes a year of attrition for it. In the end, when all the occupation armies are subjected to continuous attrition, they take a step back. They will either advance forward or they will retreat backward. But the issue is bigger than that, considering that retreating without achieving the goals is tantamount to defeat for Israel. And the repercussions of this defeat in this region and at this stage are just greater than the fact that Israel is no longer able to stay in the Gaza Strip. In fact, its repercussions are strategic, especially since everything has started with the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. This story also has another side, which is the issue of the captives. So, will the Israelis leave? Will the captives issue be resolved, even partially? Or will a truce be reached? We're facing an intertwined scene, which includes field dimensions, political dimensions, complex internal dimensions, regional dimensions, and the international dimensions. Therefore, when many variables are available, the possibilities are multiplied and new possibilities open up. But they revolve around one axis. The Israelis have not been able to achieve their goals and do not seem to be able to achieve them anytime soon. Therefore, we're facing a new reality, awaiting what repercussions it'll have inside Israel.
And to the issue of the Zionist captives held by the resistance in Gaza, some of whom were killed and are being killed in the Israeli bombing and raids on the Gaza Strip, the Hebrew media has broadcast an audio of them pleading for help from the occupation soldiers before they were killed by a bullet. Mr. Ali Haider, in your opinion, how did this audio track affect the families of the Zionist captives in light of the accusations against Netanyahu of sacrificing their children for the benefit of his political future in order to remain in power by prolonging this aggression?
In fact, it is expected and it is natural that it will have a real shock, not only on the families of the two soldiers, but also on all the families of the captives and a certain segment of the Israeli public. But what is striking is that the majority of the Israeli public still supports the continuation of the war and the continuation of the war on the Gaza Strip, again, for the same reason, which is the failure to achieve the goals. Therefore, they cannot retreat and they face a great strategic danger that will escalate if they are not able to eradicate Hamas and the rest of the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip. In any case, the Israeli internal political scene may be more complex now, given that the divisions within the regime have increased after Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, the divisions that prevailed before it.
We will address this topic, but let us remain with the captives and with the families of the captives who are in agony because their children are getting killed at the hands of the occupation army. They've continued their protests, demanding Netanyahu's resignation and holding early elections. Mr. Ali Haider, in your opinion, what impact do these demonstrations have on Benjamin Netanyahu's decisions regarding the captives' exchange deal?
In fact, so far, it has had an impact, but it is not very significant and has not yet been able to reach the stage of changing direction to the extent required. However, Netanyahu fears that this phenomenon will turn into a snowball that grows larger with the passing of time, especially since every shift in public opinion comes cumulatively and not suddenly all at once. There are issues that are reinforced by the failure in the field and reinforced by the enemy's failure to liberate Israeli captives. So Netanyahu may be dealing with them seriously. He's concerned with where these public protests will go. But so far, it seems that he is still adhering to his positions and relying on a solid social base that supports him in his choices.
The political divisions are deepening, and the failure in the war in Gaza has led to the resignation of officers in the Israeli Army Spokesman's Unit, which has raised many questions about its causes at a time when the aggression against the Gaza Strip continues without achieving the declared goals. So, Mr. Ali Haider, the scenes become more complicated when we look at the repercussions of these resignations among the high ranks of the Israeli Army Spokesman's Unit within the regime.
In fact, this phenomenon may have several dimensions, but it is not as imagined. Some may imagine that it will have repercussions at the political level, considering that it is a problem within the army institution. Indeed, it may benefit from it in some sense. Rather, its a problem is that it may have negative effects on the army and also the view of the Israeli public. With regard to the army in general, the phenomenon of resignations in this number, at this time, and in this war context, indicates that there is a fundamental defect that those concerned could not adapt to, even in light of the war context, and they were not able to ignore it. The problem may be greater than the same situation exists in other units, and it may be on the verge of explosion.
Will it have an effect in terms of the field?
In terms of the field, I do not think so. But it affects the confidence of the Israeli public in the army, and this will reveal later, especially since the issue is a matter of information. I mean, we are facing a situation that will reveal later the extent of the lies and deception practiced by the Israeli army towards its people regarding the real field losses and results. Therefore, this may be an indicator in this direction. Then if the results appear as they are in this area, they may have an impact on the political level and on the overall scene in the Israeli regime.
And to the political level, where there is no progress in the negotiations over the issue of the truce and the captives' exchange deal. There is also no sign of an agreement that may occur before the advent of the holy month of Ramadan. So, Mr. Ali Haider, there's been no progress in the course of negotiations over the captives' exchange deal so far, but it seems that efforts are being made to achieve at least a partial or preliminary agreement before the blessed month of Ramadan.
In fact, we should not be surprised to hear about a stumble or a failure. This is normal and expected. Sometimes talking about negotiations going well does not mean that it is necessarily an indicator of optimism. We're facing a very complex issue that needs more time. Things become clearer as the time passes, and as a result of the pressure of the month of Ramadan, and also the exhaustion of the occupation forces in the field in the long term. Sooner or later, I am personally convinced this issue will be reached, but the question is at what cost? The problem is neither with Hamas nor with the Israelis regarding the issue of the captives exchange deal. Israelis are concerned with the captives that Hamas has got. They're worried that Hamas has not brought them into Gaza for feeding them, but for getting them killed on their own land. But here, the issue for him is the issue of the prices and the guarantees. The problem here is that the occupation does not agree to what Hamas demands, and this is quite normal. What is the way out? If the two sides insist on their own positions, the solution that is being worked on should include stages, and the problematic issues that may blow up in the negotiations should be postponed with the hope that this will lead to the liberation of about 40 Israeli captives in exchange for hundreds of Palestinian abductees, humanitarian aid, and so on, within a truce extending to several years. The Americans want it to calm things down, considering that this will be reflected on the regional fronts as well. And this also gives the U.S. government time to exhaust the political process for the stage that follows this truce.
Benny Gantz travels to the United States at the invitation of American officials, and this constitutes a blow to Netanyahu, as one Israeli commentator has described it as the American finger in Netanyahu's eyes. The United States' motives for receiving Benny Gantz without Netanyahu's permission are an attempt to push something away from the current scene, which is Netanyahu. Mr. Ali Haider, what is the truth behind Washington's motives for receiving Benny Gantz without Netanyahu's permission and approval? In your opinion, is there any intention on the part of the Americans that indicates perhaps certain plans for amendments to Netanyahu's administrations?
Firstly, this step reflects the level of crisis the relationship between the two people, Biden and Netanyahu. Secondly, there are real divisions within the Netanyahu administration. Thirdly, it may be true that it is an indication that the Americans are showing a red card to Netanyahu, but more importantly, does this actually affect Netanyahu? Let us first observe if Gantz resigns from the administration with his partners. They do not affect the stability of the administration, because the administration essentially, without them, is based on 64 Knesset members from the right-wing parties, and therefore it has more than half plus one, and it does not affect its stability and continuity. Secondly, its continuation may benefit Netanyahu, because then it'll appear to the Israeli right-wing public that it's standing up to American pressure in order not to give up Israeli interests. If the crisis affects the image of relations between America and Israel and the position of the Israeli public, it is natural, because the relationship between America and Israel is a relationship that even those who criticize it agree upon. Therefore, if this matter leaves an impact on the Israeli public opinion and contributes to the Israeli public's pressure on Netanyahu as a result of this matter, we will be facing another scene. In addition, if Biden takes measures to put real pressure on Israel, meaning reducing aid, for example, military, financial, etc., then we will be facing a different scene. But the tools that are being used regarding what they say about American pressure on Israel have so far been effective on Netanyahu, even though they may be useful to him in one way or another.
After all, the Americans are very frustrated with the Netanyahu administration, which is obstructing reaching a truce and a captives exchange deal in preparation for advancing the path of subjugation, according to the words of a former Israeli ambassador to the United States. Gantz leads Netanyahu in the latest opinion polls conducted in the regime, as the minister's party won 39 seats in the War Council compared to 17 won by the Likud party. And to the Israeli social media that reacted to the result of this opinion poll through sarcastic comments against Netanyahu. And here are some of them.
Or, elections now.
Oren,
how delicious it is to hear that Likud is collapsing.
Angelini.
No one is worthy. Let them all quit and start again.
BN.
As a prime minister who has no qualifications and causes only harm, it is no wonder there are demands to replace him.
Limor.
Netanyahu, you must leave. Your place in history is the destruction of the temple.
Mr. Ali Haider, do you see a link between Gantz's visit to the United States and the opinion polls that reveal progress, meaning his lead over Netanyahu in any future elections?
There may be a link, but indirectly, in the sense that it is this shift in public opinion towards the person of Netanyahu that the Americans want to invest in and continue to put pressure on Netanyahu. But there is another side, that these polls in themselves constitute an incentive for all parties of the right-wing administration not to abandon each other and cling to the administration. Why? Because if the elections take place in light of such public opinion, then they will not see the administration in the future, and it'll be eliminated or a major blow will be dealt to their political ideological project with regard to the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Therefore, things are usually not one-dimensional. They're not either negative or positive. It is both negative and positive because the polls raise fears for Netanyahu and raise fears for those who are humbled by the issue of the conscription law. They may think, what if they resign and the administration falls? What happens to them in the elections? Even the same concerned parties within Israel do not know where things will go, especially in light of this dimension, in light of this bloc or very sharp social polarization. Yes, Gantz hopes that the elections will take place now in light of the polls, but the elections have a legal path, meaning that either the prime minister resigns and an alternative administration is not formed, or a number of members of the cabinet defect and join the opposition, or that there is a law that has a majority in the Knesset that dissolves the Knesset and the administration. And none of these scenarios are clear yet.
The specialist in Israeli affairs, Mr. Ali Haider, thank you so much for participating in this episode of Israel Watch, and thank you. Until we meet again, God willing.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Some Western champions of feminist cause have reserved their fury for the plight of Zionist women, ignoring the catastrophic suffering in Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, from the outset of the war on Gaza, an unsettling narrative has permeated Western media, portraying the fabricated regime of Israel as a paragon of civilization. Some pundits have even gone as far as reducing the Palestinian people to the level of the animal kingdom. Such bias is nothing new, further amplified in the UK by outlets such as Unheard, as media propaganda continues the unsettling tradition of misrepresenting the Arab community. But it has been unexpectedly troubling to hear such distortions echoed by British feminists and activists. If you're following the well-known UK feminist in hopes of finding a united outcry and empathy for the violence faced by Palestinian women and children, I'm afraid you will be deeply disappointed. Despite the International Court of Justice warning that the Zionist regime's onslaught in Gaza could plausibly be a genocide, some of Western feminism's most vocal champions against gendered violence seem to have reserved their solidarity for Zionist women alone, accusing the international community of remaining silent about the unsubstantiated claims of rapes and sexual assaults against Zionist women on October 7th. Yet the absence of comparable empathy and fury for the plight of Palestinian women and children reveals a shocking double standard and deep moral failure. This is not the first time Western feminists have fallen short. This brand of feminism, with its history of shining a spotlight only on issues palatable to Western taste, often ignores the concerns of brown women. This disturbing pattern is unmistakably evident in what's widely referred to as imperial feminism. Yet, the dire situation facing Palestinian women and children in Gaza has not benefited from similarly loud and passionate advocacy. It's as though feminist iron power selectively rears its head for issues that fit a decidedly Western narrative of liberation, leaving others, such as those in Palestine, in the shadows. The history of imperial feminism is like a broken record, replacing and replaying the same errors without learning lessons. Draped in the lofty notion of liberation, it often imposes Western values on women around the globe, leaving chaos in its wake. Once again, this brand of feminism overlooks the fact that women, no matter where they are, possess their own voices and resilience. Imperial feminism subtly perpetuates the notion that Western methods are superior, while sidelining the rich tapestry of views that West Asian women hold and the grassroots feminists fighting for change at home. This glaring oversight begs the question, why is it that only Zionist women receive expressions of concern or sympathy from some Western feminist? Is it because they are seen as more akin to Western feminist ideals and thus deemed more worthy? When Western feminism, amplified by the media, embraces the portrayal of the Zionist regime as just an underdog hitting back at terrorism, and any criticism of Zionist regime's actions is swiftly branded as anti-Semitism, the ordeal of Palestinian women caught in the conflict is grievously ignored. UN reports have given detailed accounts of Palestinian women suffering sexual violence and torture in the Zionist regime's custody. Why aren't we seeing floods of articles championing their cause? There are also young children being abducted and denied their rights. Doesn't that stir something in you, push you to shout about it? It's noteworthy how quickly numerous pieces in solidarity with the Zionist women were published, but a mere mention of the violence affecting Palestinian women seems too much to ask for. Can you clearly condemn the Zionist regime's actions and the ongoing oppression of Palestinians? The silence from those who should be the most vocal against the violence inflicted upon the women and children of Gaza contradicts the very principles